Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Governor Charlie Baker has until midnight to sign or reject a massive climate legislation package. If approved, the bill would require Massachusetts to reduce its emissions 50% below 1990 levels in the next 10 years and to be net zero by 2050. Now, WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser has been reporting on the legislation, joins us now. Miriam, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Miriam, right after the bill came out of committee, we had State Senator Michael Barrett on the show. He was one of the bill's key architects. He said that he'd worked closely with the governor's team throughout the process of drafting. He didn't think the differences between the two sides would be what he called deal killer. He hoped Baker would sign it. Baker hasn't signed it. So why?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. Baker's been asked about this a bunch of times, and he's just continued to say that he and his team are reviewing it. He's definitely frustrated that the legislature got it to him at the very end of the session, because that's meant that there was never an option for him to send it back with amendments or do any sort of negotiation. And remember, this is all happening just weeks after his team put out its own really ambitious climate plan. They spent more than a year doing research and trying to put together a series of roadmaps for what they thought would be the best way forward. And there's a lot of overlap between the two plans. You know, they both share the same sort of grand vision for decarbonizing transportation, buildings, the energy sector, you name it. But there are some key differences. And if the bill gets vetoed, that will probably be why.
So just to pick up on that, you said, you know, you got it sort of last minute. You mean like bleeding edge last minute, right?
Yeah, like day before the session ends, kind of last minute.
Yeah. Okay, so what could happen in the next 9 hours?
Right. There are three things that could happen. Baker could sign it, he could veto it, or he could do what's called a pocket veto, which essentially means that he would do nothing, and that is a de facto veto.
Okay, so I'm assuming playing into that are these key differences that you mentioned. Tell us, I think there are two, right? Tell us about each and who is upset about them.
Yeah. So the first big sticking point is really all about how quickly we cut emissions. Both the legislature and the governor have goals of radically reducing emissions by 2050, as you mentioned above, but they differ in how much of that we need to do or how much of that we need to achieve by 2030. If we take our emissions from 1990 as sort of this base level, the governor said we need to cut that by 45% by 2030. And the legislature says, no, we need to do 50%. And 5%, a 5% difference might not sound like much, but it's actually like a really, really big deal. And the administration is worried that if we move too quickly, we could actually set ourselves backwards and that the whole transition will end up costing a lot more. And then the other big sticking point is something called stretch codes, which is super wonky sounding, I know, but here's how to think about it. We have statewide building codes, and those include efficiency standards, right? And a number of years ago, some cities and towns said that they wanted to go further and require more efficient buildings. So the legislature created these so-called stretch codes, which allow these cities and towns to opt into these higher standards. And fast forward to today, and the legislature wants to update those stretch codes to the point where municipalities could mandate that all new buildings actually have net zero emissions, so be like super climate friendly. And it sounds great, but some in the real estate and development world are nervous about this. They say that the bill moves too quickly on this. You know, the bill says that cities can do this pretty much within a year of the bill becoming law. And in their mind, that creates a lot of uncertainty, which is bad for the industry. And I spoke yesterday with Tamara Small of NIAP Massachusetts, which is a commercial real estate development association. And here's what she told me about this.
Our concern is that there have not been that many net zero buildings built, particularly commercial buildings in the Commonwealth. And we're also concerned that this could really hinder economic development. So yes, are we going to get to net zero eventually? Absolutely. Are we going to be there within 1 year where it could potentially be the base code in the large majority of communities in the Commonwealth? That's where the real concern is.
All right, so those are the key sticking points. What about people who want him to sign it before midnight tonight? What do they say?
Yeah, so on stretch code specifically, they say that the issue has been totally overblown and that there's plenty of precedent around the world for how to build really green buildings. And on some of the other differences, they say, you know, reasonable people can disagree about certain things, but at the end of the day, they say this is a really strong climate bill that does a lot to address a variety of problems. And for that reason, the administration should sign it. And Tiziana, right before you and I started talking, I was on the phone with Elizabeth Henry Turnbull of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Her group has gone all in on the bill, and she told me she's still hoping Baker signs it for three reasons.
First, this bill is the most ambitious of any kind of its kind in the nation. And if it's passed, Massachusetts unambiguously leads, and we set a roadmap for other states and nations to follow. Second, it puts Massachusetts on a path to a cleaner, healthier, more equitable future, and it turbocharges our clean energy sector. And third, the legislature and the administration both want so much of the same things.
All right, so now we know what people on both sides have been saying over the last 10 days. It's a bit of a black box. Any clues on who the governor's listening to?
Yeah, so it sounds to me like he's listening to those with concerns, like NIAP, you know, that maybe those people have persuaded him. Our colleague Steve Brown asked him about the bill this afternoon, and Baker immediately brought up stretch codes. So here's what he said.
One of my big concerns is I've gotten a lot of incoming from a lot of folks who are in the building and home construction business who've said that certain pieces of this bill, which remember I can't amend and send back, literally may just stop in its tracks any housing development in the Commonwealth. And those words get my attention.
So yeah, you know, I don't have a crystal ball here, but it sounds like he's hinting at a veto.
Okay, so if he vetoes or does this pocket veto thing where he just doesn't sign it but doesn't send it back or anything, what happens next?
Right. So leaders in the House and Senate vowed yesterday to refile the bill immediately. And if Baker vetoes it again, they should have enough votes to override that. And if Baker sends it back with proposed amendments, they could decide to negotiate. And, you know, while negotiation always sounds like a great thing, some environmental advocates that I've been talking to are worried that this will just open the door to another 2 years of back and forth. You know, they're worried that we won't end up with an actual climate law before July 2022. And given the climate crisis and, you know, the fact that we probably should have started addressing it yesterday, they say it is just too long to wait. So to summarize, we're in the 11th hour here, and it is a real nail biter.
It is. Miriam, before I let you go, I just want to clarify. So the last legislative session sent him this bill. So you and I both said this, but I just want to clarify. He technically can't send it back with amendments because this is a different legislature, right? He can either veto it or ignore it, and they're going to have to resubmit it for there to be a back and forth, correct?
Exactly. And the leaders in the House and Senate have said that that's exactly what they plan to do if he vetoes it. So they will refile, you know, as soon as a couple days from now.
Okay. Thank you for that. WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser, we will follow this with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton was one of 232 members of the United States House of Representatives who voted to impeach President Donald Trump for the second time yesterday. 197 members voted against it. Outside the Capitol, we have continued outrage and repercussions for last week's insurrection there, even as we see more threats of more violence as Inauguration Day approaches. Now, WBUR has tried to bring you the voices of our delegation here in Massachusetts as much as possible while these events unfold. We're going to do it again. Congressman Seth Moulton joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Congressman.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
I cannot imagine what it is to be a congressperson right now. What is in your heart and head today?
Well, it's certainly the most frightening time for our country that I've ever seen in my lifetime. Our democracy is being tested. And let's be clear, it's being tested from within, which I think makes it that much more challenging. We are defending democracy from the president. There are more U.S. troops right now in Washington, D.C. than in Afghanistan, and they're there to defend the Capitol from the president and his mob.
As a former soldier.
This is no small big, this is a big deal.
It sounds like it. As a former soldier, what's it like for you to see soldiers sleeping on the floor of the U.S. Capitol? Those pictures have been all over the country the last day.
I mean, with all due respect, not a former soldier, a Marine veteran, but it is frightening.
I am so sorry. That is a fair correction.
The last time we had troops in the U.S. Capitol, it was to stop the Confederates from crossing the Potomac, to protect the Capitol during a civil war. And, you know, the amazing thing about that time is the Confederate flag never breached the Capitol. But supporters of the President of the United States were parading the Confederate flag through the Capitol after he incited the mob and asked them to go down the street and raid this temple of American democracy. It's never happened before in American history. And so to have my Republican colleagues saying, oh, no, now's not a time for accountability. We just need to find unity. This from the most divisive party in American history. It's hard to understand. It's hard to come to terms with, and it's hard to envision working with my colleagues on anything else while we still have this hanging over our heads.
So let's talk about that, because we now have a pretty good sense from the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that he's not going to take this up in the Senate before the inauguration. The Boston Globe's reporting today, potentially it could be taken up on the day of the inauguration. You said it's kind of hard to imagine moving forward on anything else until this is done. What if it doesn't get taken up until next Wednesday or beyond? Is there something lost?
I think that it would be better if it were taken up sooner, but no. At the end of the day, trials get delayed, and sometimes you need more time. What matters is that we hold the president accountable, because we are a country of laws, and one of the foundational principles of our democracy is that the law applies to everyone. So you don't get a free ride if you're the president of the United States. You don't get your supporters to just say, oh, well, we need unity, so we shouldn't prosecute you. We need to hold people accountable. And just as we need to hold the mob accountable, those rioters, those who were beating the Capitol Police and trying to find us, members of Congress, so that they could assassinate us, yes, they need to be held accountable, but so do the people who incited them, who asked them to do this, including the President of the United States.
Congressman, I want to key in on the fact that you just said those essentially who sought to assassinate us. And I want to key in on the fact that Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley has said that the panic buttons in her office were inexplicably removed sometime before the riot. Do you feel that there was an assassination attempt in what happened last week? And do you feel that there were people targeted? And if so, how does accountability happen?
It's very clear that people were targeted. There's evidence of that just in some of the videos that have emerged, but we also know it from some of the intelligence reports and briefings that we've received, not only looking backwards on the riot, but looking forward towards the inauguration. So all of this needs to be investigated thoroughly. I mean, imagine, Tiziana, for a second, if after the Boston Marathon bombing, there was a whole contingent of Americans who had just said, wait, now's not a time to prosecute. Now is not a time for accountability. We just need to heal. No, we need to hold lawbreakers accountable. We need to hold the President of the United States accountable for something that no other president has done in American history, even despite terrible, racist, awful presidents we've had. No president has actually organized a mob against our democracy, attacked democracy itself, the foundations of our government. A lot of presidents have disagreed with Congress. That happens, that's a every day of week kind of thing. But never has a president said, go attack Congress. Go be tough, show them how to do their job.
I'm so struck by your analogy to the Boston Marathon bombing. In talking with other members of Congress on the other side of this, those saying we need unity and those defending, in some cases, the president, have you used that analogy? And what responses do you get?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I haven't used that analogy. Maybe I should start. But what I have been spending my time doing is sitting down. I spent 20 or 30 minutes sitting down on the floor of the House a few hours before the impeachment vote with someone who I thought I could convince, someone who I thought might change his mind to do the right thing for the country. And I made a lot of different arguments for him, but most importantly, I just answered all of his questions. Well, I don't think we've had enough time. You don't always have time. Oh, I don't think the process has been perfect. No vote we take is ever perfect. You know, I don't think that we've heard the full story. In no trial do you ever hear the full story. The jury never knows every single fact. At some point they say, okay, we've heard enough and it's time for the judgment to be made. So I answered all these questions, and at the end of the day, he said, I'm grateful for your time, and you've really made me think. You've really made me think. But did he have the courage to change his vote? No, he didn't. He didn't. He wasn't one of the 10. And that makes me sad, because I thought was a better, stronger person than that. And what this comes down to for so many of these Republicans, the vast majority, is not about whether they think it's right or wrong, because they all know the right thing to do. It's just about whether they have the political courage to take a tough vote, to do the right thing for our country, even when it might hurt their reelection prospects back home.
I want to ask you for a minute about the inauguration. Are you going, and do you feel safe going?
I am going, and no, I don't feel completely safe. I'm going because it's the right thing to do for our democracy. It's the right thing for me as the representative of the 6th District of Massachusetts to show up and honor the peaceful transition of power. But I would be lying to you if I told you I felt completely safe. We've received intelligence briefings about the various extremist groups, domestic terror organizations, that have very specific plots against inauguration, against the president, against members of Congress. I'm obviously not going to go into any details here,
right. But
I can tell you that the security threat is very real. And they're all supporters of President Trump.
Okay, so I mean, there's so much here. You were just talking about the sadness in your heart when you talked to a colleague across the aisle who in the end didn't make what you thought was the hard call, and you talked about safety and courage. Here you are saying you don't feel safe going to the inauguration next week, but you're going to go anyway. Do you see that as a courageous act, and will there be a call to more courage if people overcome their fears and go and stand there next week at the inauguration and stand up?
Well, yes, I would like to think so. I mean, I want to put this in perspective because we have so many troops out there right now. I mean, I think the inauguration could be dangerous. It doesn't compare to some of the things I've had to go through as a United States Marine in Iraq. And I'm fortunate in a sort of backwards kind of way to have that perspective on this. I've heard colleagues of mine say that what they experienced last Wednesday was the most frightening day of their lives. And I understand that. And so in some ways, it's perhaps easier for me to show up for the inauguration because I've been through worse things before than for many of my colleagues. So yes, there is some real courage, I think, that we will all show by showing up, just as we had to show some courage to come back into the Capitol on Wednesday night and continue doing the people's business, to honor the election results, to honor the choice that the American people made for the next president of the United States.
Let's talk about after the inauguration. I'm still struck by you saying that the inauguration could be dangerous. That's not really a phrase I expected before this week to hear somebody say. So it will happen, and we know that there will potentially be a trial in the Senate. The new president, President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, will have to pursue an agenda. What do you think the priorities are immediately?
Well, we have a lot of work to do. I think the most immediate priority is the COVID-19 pandemic, and we could be doing so much better. I mean, you want to get the economy back on track. You want to save local restaurants. You want to get people back to work. The best way to do it is to end the pandemic, and the Trump administration has failed at this from the very beginning. So we need to speed up vaccination distribution. We need to make sure the regulations are smart and make sense, and we've got to get much more relief out to the American people, to small businesses, to individuals who have lost their jobs, to families trying to figure out how to juggle work and teaching kids school remotely. There's so much work that we have to do. People are really hurting. People are literally dying. And that's, I think,
is that an opportunity for bipartisanship? Congressman, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Is that an opportunity? Yeah.
No,
go ahead.
That's okay. That's your job. It's certainly, it certainly should be. It certainly should be. There's no reason why this shouldn't be anything but a truly American priority. It should be in everybody's interest to save lives and restart the economy. I don't understand. It's actually just truly extraordinary that the Trump administration and the lackeys in Congress who just follow his every word have turned this into a political issue. I mean, why does it have to be a political issue whether or not you wear a mask? I mean, why does it have to be a political issue whether or not you take the vaccine? I've received a lot of questions from people, first responders, folks I know who just said, I got offered the vaccine, Seth. Do you think I should take it? Of course, my answer is yes, but it's sad to even have to ask that question, right? Because we've gotten so frightened of how we handle science in this country with this administration.
We have a couple minutes left with you. There are a few other things I do want to get to. So you talked about what you think the top priority for the new administration should be. You have your own priorities. Transportation is something you have focused on a lot. You've been a proponent of, for example, of the North Station, South Station rail link. You have new legislation on high speed rail. Why now, and why is that investment so important?
It's transformative for the country. Just imagine the next time you have to go to Chicago, and instead of fighting through security lines and having inevitable weather delays and then trying to figure out how on earth you're going to get from O'Hare into the city, you simply got on a train, were there 3.5 hours later, and, oh, by the way, if people want to get off in Cleveland or Buffalo and connect with these cities that have been completely left off the map in the last 50 years, you can do that too. No weather delays ever, way, way nicer way to travel. And we always think about high-speed rail as just simply getting to New York. But if you have truly modern high-speed rail, the entire country would be connected in different ways. And so many people who live in small cities or rural communities and don't have access to the tech revolution, to the jobs that we're fortunate to have in a place like Boston, they're going to be brought together as well. So high-speed rail is an example of something that not only is good for the environment, not only produces jobs, not only it fixes our infrastructure problem, it can actually bring the country together.
And do you have a Republican colleague or colleagues that you think will join you in that legislation? Is there an opportunity to do something across the aisle there?
There are Republicans that we're working with, but amazingly, this is another place where somehow what should be a basic American priority has become partisan, and it shouldn't be. I'm excited that a high-speed rail project that I actually worked on before I came to Congress down in Texas to connect Houston and Dallas is moving forward and may well be the first high-speed rail line operational in the United States. And it's significant because it's in a red state, and I think it will change a lot of minds. To see what this can do for our country. But it's just one example of the transformative next-generation infrastructure investments we need to make. We all know we need to restore our infrastructure, but if we do it by just building more 1950s highways, if we do it by building last generation's infrastructure, we'll miss a major opportunity for America.
All right, I want to go existential with you now on the last question. And I get you can't muse on what I'm about to ask you 100% freely or openly because you have the weight of Congress, the weight of your role in your words. But I am sure you have heard, as have I, people around the Commonwealth and for you, maybe people around the country who are really worried that this is a moment where this union of disparate states may not be able to pull it through together. to those people? What do you say about how we stay together? And what do you see as your role in that?
I will tell you that although I've never seen the United States of America in a more perilous position just for the future of our democracy, I am also confident that we will prevail. I see the courage in the eyes of those troops, those young Americans who have come to Washington to fundamentally guard our democracy, and they will make our democracy prevail. I see the courage in my fellow lawmakers who have faced down these threats and still want to come to work every single day. And I see the courage all around Massachusetts, and indeed around the country, although we don't get to travel much these days, of Americans who do believe in the fundamental values that make us the most extraordinary country on earth. America has never been a great country because we've figured everything out. We've always been a country that has this undying belief that someday we just might. We're not as good as we ought to be, but someday we might get there. So we all need to continue striving. We all need to stay involved. We all need to believe there's a brighter future. I certainly do. And that's the quick thought off the top of my head, TCI, that I'd share with everyone listening today.
It was a good one. Thank you. Seth Moulton represents the Massachusetts 6th District in Congress. Congressman, thanks so much. And take care.
I will. Thanks, TCI.
You heard us talking with Congressman Seth Moulton. One of the things we discussed was the fact that yesterday the House voted to impeach President Trump, who is now the only president in our nation's history to have been impeached twice. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said during the proceedings that the president's role in encouraging supporters to storm the Capitol building last Wednesday requires a serious response.
The president of the United States incited this insurrection, this armed rebellion against our common country. He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy echoed many of his Republican colleagues in condemning last week's violence, but also the impeachment proceedings, claiming that it simply furthers the political divide.
A vote to impeach will further fan the flames of partisan division. Most Americans want neither inaction nor retribution. They want durable, bipartisan justice.
So as our team was talking this morning, we found that everywhere we turn, this is what people want to talk about right now, folks, is this the call for unity versus the call for accountability, the tension between those two things. Seems like people have very strong feelings one side or the other. And while those that sound and those people are in D.C., we here in Greater Boston, we feel this too, and we want to have a conversation with you. We want to take your pulse, find out where you are on this. 800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you make of the Republican call for unity? What do you make of the Democratic move to impeachment? What do you make of the challenges we have for unity in your neighborhood, in your town, in your county, if you think about it that way? Just call us. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Now, we have two great guests to help us reflect, help take your calls. And we're lucky because since we're a two-city daily with two newspapers, we've got one from each. We've got Joan Vinocki, the columnist from the Boston Globe, and Joe Battenfeld, columnist from the Boston Herald. Joan and Joe. I'm going to do that at least twice during this segment. Joan and Joe, welcome back. It's great to have you both.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks.
All right, so I'm going to ask you each a question. First, Joan, I will start with you. Do you feel that impeachment was a necessary step for Congress, or do you think the Democrats have gone too far with only a week left in the president's term?
Well, let me start off by saying timing in life is everything. And on January 5th, I had written a column that said they should not impeach. It was too polarizing. Then everything changed. And I think they had to do what they did. It became a matter of principle and accountability. And the fact that 10 Republicans agreed with that, I think shows that more proof that it was the right thing to do.
Now, Joe, your most recent column, Joan just referred to one of hers, your most recent one, the headline was Trump impeachment destroys Biden promises of unity and healing. So I think that gives us a signal as to how you feel about this. Why do you think this is a mistake?
I don't think it really does hold anyone accountable. There's no accountability when there's no impact. President Trump has already been removed from office, or will be in a couple of days. He's been voted out of office. And the Senate has indicated that they may not even take up impeachment at all, that they may do it when Democrats get control, but it's possible that they could let it die. And anyway, they don't have the ability. I don't think they have the ability to get 2/3 of the vote right now to remove President Trump from office, which he'll already be removed from office anyway. So there's no real impact here. And I, if you really want to hold President Trump accountable, go after him on legal grounds, investigate him for his role in this, in these riots. And he did have a role in the riots, and I agree with that. Investigate him, and if necessary, charge him.
Joan, I'm going to give you a chance to respond there.
Thank you. On the issue of impact, I think the impact comes from making every representative, every lawmaker, every senator vote, stand up and be counted. If you listen to the Republicans yesterday, most of them weren't saying that there wasn't an impeachable offense. They keep on talking about unity and, you know, the need to bring the country together. They know that what President Trump did was wrong. I think they should have to vote on it and let the people see where they cast their vote.
So that's a different spin, Joe. And then the phones are blowing up. So after I ask you this question, Joe, I'll go to the phones. That's a different spin. That is, well, the accountability is to the congressional members who have to take a vote versus whether or not it removes the president from office before January 20th.
Well, that's going to, I mean, that is going a real far distance to prove a point, to hold individual Congress people accountable. They're already accountable every 2 years. And we know, you know, pretty much where they stand on this. All you have to do is ask them where they stand on it. So I don't believe you have to fan the flames and get the temperature of this country up even further by going forward with an impeachment that's not going anywhere anyway.
Fan the flames, right, though. I mean, you had people, you know, storming the Capitol, putting the lives of these lawmakers at risk as well. And you would think that alone would make them think that this was something that they would need to hold Trump accountable for.
Let's go to the phones here. Again, they're just blowing up. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll take a few calls here. Let's start with Dean in Hyde Park. Dean, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was listening to Congressman Moulton recount trying to persuade a Republican colleague to vote for impeachment. And I think we need to take a moment to reflect on how state legislatures have shaped and distorted the legislative branch of the federal government. Because if I'm not mistaken, it is state legislatures that control redistricting. And a heavily gerrymandered district always renders a general election irrelevant. And so whether or not congressmen or senators on the right have the political courage to stand up and do what is right, they will be primaried. There is no way in a gerrymandered district to prevent an extremist from holding office. And that is what we are seeing with those who wanted to object to certifying the results of a free and fair election, those who now want to give the president a pass for inciting a mob.
So, Dean, thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have so many calls, and I feel like we've got a good sense of your point. So I'm going to let you go. Thank you for that. I want to add a couple more. We've got Anthony on the line from Newton. Anthony, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I don't see impeachment as retribution at all. You can't operate with impunity, and the punishment hardly fits the crime. But I do agree, though, that I don't think this will come to anything needing a 2/3 vote. And one quick thought. I think this kind of behavior began when he called to free Wisconsin and they showed up on the Capitol steps with AR-15s. That was a warning call to the United States of America. And I think access to the Capitol was way too easy. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but that was way too easy.
Thank you for that, Anthony. And I don't know if we'll take a look. I'm trying to remember how many years ago that was, but that was a while back. And I'm going to grab one more call here and we'll go back to our guests. We've got Arlene on the line from Lawrence. Arlene, jump in.
Thank you. I see that the president should be held accountable. He is an accessory, as they would say in layman's terms. He was an active participant by inciting that. And I just don't want him ever to have any government office held, president, senator, nothing. Get him out as quickly and as swiftly as possible. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, Arlene. So a lot there. And I mean, this is the heat, right? We are all in the middle of the heat. Joe, I think I'll start with you on Dean's point. You said, you know, accountability is elections every 2 years. Sounds like he's saying we have messed that up. We have gerrymandered ourselves into lack of accountability. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, that's a whole other topic that you could get into, the gerrymandering. And it does occur on both sides, depending on which, you know, legislature has the power. But I still think you still have an election, and gerrymandering can't. We've seen that in the last election where a number of incumbents were thrown out of office. So it is possible to do that.
And Joan, I want to turn to you. One of the things that struck me with the other two callers was just the raw anger in their voices. And I'm still thinking about you saying that, you know, the impeachment vote is an accountability moment for members of the legislature. I hear a lot of people asking what to do about Republican representatives who doubled down on what I've heard some NPR hosts call the big lie, which is false, unsubstantiated claims about election fraud that were consistently disproven in court.
Okay, could I go to the primary issue, though, before I get to that?
You can go anywhere you want. This is free for all, Joan. Jump in on all of it.
Is it so terrible to be primaried? I mean, this is a democracy. What's the worst thing in the world? You know, that you have to run for re-election and that you might lose? I mean, I'm not in elected office, so I guess it's easy for me to say. But there should be some principle that you're willing to stand up for. So, I mean, the idea that people don't want to be primary seems to me, you know, a bad reason not to vote to impeach a president if you think that president has committed impeachable offenses. Maybe that's naive, maybe it's idealistic, but, you know, that's the way I feel about that. In terms of the, you know, the anger and the raw emotion, and whether or not how you hold congresspeople, lawmakers accountable for votes they cast. I mean, I think that is up to the voters. If the voters of a district want to reelect somebody who's done that, that's their call. May not be a popular position.
Let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255. We've got Rick on the line from Jamaica Plain. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, the only thing I could compare what happened to was like when the Black Panthers were carrying arms back in the 60s. And what happened with them was the FBI infiltrated them and dismantled them in a sense. The Proud Boys are getting a free ride here. They went in and nobody's complaining about them. They're saying it's Trump's fault. Trump instigated them for sure. But they're the ones that are walking around with their guns and nobody's saying, oh, we got to get rid of the Proud Boys. Back in the 60s, there were three college campuses where there were civil rights marches, and three or four Black people were shot in South Carolina, Louisiana, and Texas, Texas Southern University in the 60s. Black people were shot at rallies. So, you know, it's a total, you know, 360 on how they treat people at rallies like this. This is insane. And, you know, Trump instigated it totally. If I told somebody constantly, like that, the girl that got away with telling her boyfriend to kill himself, she got put in jail for telling him she got tweets that said, go kill yourself. Well, he told people to go jump on the Capitol. That's what he told them. So it's a double standard in how, you know, the FBI is treating the Proud Boys.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate that. And I admit that the name of the young woman in the trial, I'm picturing her in my head. We've talked about it repeatedly here on Radio Boston, but I forget her name. So, Joe, what about Rick is saying, hey, the Proud Boys are getting a pass. We do know that federal agents are spanning out across the country trying to arrest people and find people and hold them accountable. But we also know the President of the United States said Proud Boys stand by.
Yeah, this was during the debates, I believe, right? You're talking about?
I am.
Yeah, and it clearly had a role in what happened at the Capitol. President Trump did, and he, you know, that's obvious. But you know, I think in fact the FBI right now is doing a pretty good job of trying to get to the root of people who did instigate this and who were at the Capitol and who did have a role in this. They're arresting people already. And certainly anybody, and I agree that any groups like the Proud Boys who are talking about bringing guns now, there is a heavy investigation right now into the inauguration and people who are threatening to bring guns to that. So hopefully they can infiltrate that.
I do wonder, and by the way, it was Michelle Carter. I so apologize that I just couldn't bring that name to the front of my mind then. I do wonder, and Joan, I guess I'll turn to you on this. We've had Joan Donovan from Harvard University, a researcher, on, who reminded us that domestic right-wing groups have been designated as a huge terrorist threat by federal law enforcement agencies. The Proud Boys have not been quiet about their intentions, and they marched on Washington just a couple weeks before this all happened, destroying property, tearing down flags from Black churches. Should we have been in a better position to stop them? And how are we now in a moment where we know armed people are coming for other people in America next week?
Well, I think the caller made an excellent point about the double standard in how people are treated. They're making arrests now, and the FBI finally seems to be on the case. But, you know, the question that's been raised since the assault happened is, if that many Black Lives Matters protesters or rioters or mob, whatever you want to call them, storm the Capitol, how many dead people would there be in the aftermath? Would they have been met with the same, sort of carte blanche to walk, waltz around and do what they did? And I think most people think the answer is no, that the response would have been different, and that there is a clear double standard as to how the Proud Boys should be handled in the future. I don't know. I've been listening to podcasts and things about this whole crazy internet world out there, and I just really don't know how you stop them. It seems really hard.
All right, I'm going to go back to the phones because I want to keep us focused on the pulse of how people here in Greater Boston are experiencing this. We've got Michelle on the line from Chatham. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi. The one thing that gets me with all of these conversations that the Republicans are having is that they're still blaming the Democrats for things. Instead, if they want unity, why don't they just come forward and say it has all been a lie and we agree that President Trump did wrong and he should be charged for the crime?
Let's go to Joe Battenfeld on that. Thank you, Michelle. Joe, what about the calls? And we've heard them, even Congressman McGovern here from our delegation saying, if you want to make a difference here, just say it isn't true. Just tell people the truth. And Mitt Romney saying leadership is telling people the truth.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, there have been some Republicans who have said what the president did was wrong, but I don't think enough. Clearly, I mean, I've been consistent and I've never once challenged the validity of the election or said that the election was not valid. But I think some people did. Obviously, a lot of Republicans did go along with that, what President Trump was saying, and that was wrong too. But they should stand up now and say, I think what people want to do now is stand up and say, okay, what President Trump did was clearly wrong. If he did something illegal, he should be investigated for that. But the country also needs to move on. We have, you know, thousands of people dying every day, and we have a vaccine that's the rollout is being slowed down, and it should be going faster, and there should be a better government response in this. And so I think there are a lot of the things that we should be focusing on.
So Joan, in part of what Joe just said, and I feel like we touched on this sort of obliquely in our conversation with Congressman Moulton before the break, every minute that our Congress spends on this is a minute that it's not 100% focused on helping our country survive and get through what has been a poorly managed pandemic. How do you think about that trade-off when thinking about having attention on impeachment right now or not on unity as it's being framed by Republicans in Congress?
Well, I think handling a pandemic is very important, but having a democracy to survive is important too. And again, I mean, I think the caller made a great point. I mean, how to unify people? One way to unify people is for Republicans and Democrats to just say what happened was wrong and that the president should be held accountable for it. And I understand the time frame that Joe is raising. And I understand. I mean, I'd like to think that the Congress can, to use an overused phrase, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. They certainly, Republicans in the past, were able to decide that, you know, that a president who had lied about sex with an intern should be impeached. But somehow a president who incited a riot in the U.S. Capitol shouldn't be held to that same standard. So, you know, put me under, I just don't really get that argument.
I want to get one more caller voice in here. Jonathan's on the line from Stoneham. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to address this idea that impeachment is pointless in the last week of a president's term. When you impeach someone, you also vote on whether to bar them from ever holding federal office again. So I think it would be very productive to have all of these members of Congress on record saying that they're fine with him running in 2024 after this happened.
Thanks for that, Jonathan. So Joe Battenfeld, that is another big question. What does the Republican Party do with the possibility of a recurring Donald Trump?
Yeah, that is a big question. They're going to have to decide that. The Republican Party is going to have to decide whether they really want Trump to be involved in 2024 or not. And I think Trump has been severely weakened because of what happened at the Capitol. And I don't think he's going to be a viable candidate. You know, he may try, but I, you know, and the Republican Party is going to go through a bloodbath over this. But in the end, I hope that they can decide to move on to somebody else.
How about you, Joan?
Well, the easiest way to neuter him politically would be to convict him in the Senate and make it so that he couldn't run again. And I bet there is some political, you know, there's a lot of political self-interest, actually, for Republicans who think they want to run for president in having that happen. I'm no, you know, sort of expert on where how the vote would go in the Senate. I'm watching CNN like everybody else, but it sounds like people think that there are at least 5 to 7 senators who might vote for conviction, Republicans, and that's not enough. But, you know, I think, again, that they should do it. They should take the vote. They should make everyone go on record and give their speeches to why. I mean, McConnell has already said he thinks Trump has committed impeachable offenses.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate the two of you helping us have this conversation with our listeners. Lines were still full, so obviously this is a thing that is on everyone's minds. Joan Vanacki, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Joe Battenfeld, columnist for the Boston Herald. Really appreciate both of you joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thanks a lot.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Join us again tomorrow when Dr. Anthony Fauci will join us on Radio Boston.